So it basically inspired at some level by the infrared workshop that we had that Louis and Sarah ran so well, I guess it was last October. And in particular, some the work that Paul Yerkes has been doing, trying to understand whether the sitter space is stable or not. And he has, I'll sort of try to go over some of his arguments about why he thinks there might be a real problem in the sitter space. And what we're really doing in this, we're at some level, we're being partially agnostic as to whether he's right or wrong, because we're not yet at the point where we can really tackle it the way he would like to tackle it. However, we have what we really have here, and what I really want to develop more, is we have formalism that can actually that we think can actually start trying to address the questions that he wants to in a sharper sort of way. And we do have some partial results for cases where, in some limits, we think we know what the answer ought to be. It's a bit of a technical thought because it does develop formalism, so it might get a little, you know, that, you might not enjoy that part so much, and I apologize, but, you know, tough. but we do have some results that are coming, you know, towards the end there. But I think the formalism itself, it's sort of one that's well-known in quantum optics. It's a Weisskopf-Wigner approximation for line widths and atomic spectra and quantum optics and the like. But this is sort of an interesting application to field theory in an expanding universe. Okay, so deep down inside, my philosophy was generated by Frank Zappa's philosophy on guitar playing. You shut up and play your guitar. And our point of view is, as opposed to just sort of talking about how things ought to happen and not really wanting to sit down and calculate, it's really time to shut up and calculate. So that's why we're doing this thing, that we want to be able to get to the point where we can do that. And, you know, everybody should get all Frank Zappa's albums. So here's sort of an outline of what I want to discuss. First, sort of just go at some level relatively quickly over Polyakov's argument, because there's just the one argument restated in a variety of ways with extra, you know, either doing it in the full de Sitter or in the Poincaré patch and so forth. But there's just the one argument. Then I want to develop this Wigner-Weisskopf method. If you haven't seen it before in your quantum classes, you'll see it first here. And if you have seen it, it's a reminder, and sort of we make contact with standard field theory results that will sort of help you navigate this. And then we apply it to the sitter space. And in doing so, we kind of find there's an interesting possibility that I'll try to discuss, not deeply, because it's calculational and you have to go through a lot of technicalities. You should read the paper, which is a marvel of the English language at this point. I mean, it truly is just a gem. You really ought to read it. And in the conclusions, I'll sort of discuss what we did and talk about where what we do here is sort of a very easy case that we know what the answers ought to look like. And even there, we find some surprises. But then sort of what the further directions ought to be in order to actually do the physics that Polyakov is trying to do. So I don't have to say this here, but if you got questions as I go along, ask about it. So first of all, you know, why do we care? There's certainly the in-principle question of, well, I'm in the sitter space, and it's kind of a nice space-time. It's got a lot of symmetry. Can I really do quantum field theory in those space-times? Just as an in-principle question, that's sort of worth asking. But let's face it, no one would really be doing much of anything with that if that was the only reason. These are the reasons deep down inside, right? There's the issue of the sitter space is not a bad approximation to what happens during inflation. And so we ought to try to understand that aspect of it. And perhaps we're running towards an endpoint of the sitter space due to the dark energy, and that's sort of worth trying to understand what goes on at that level as well. So there's physics, there are good physics reasons to worry about this question, on top of what I actually do think is not an unreasonable in-principle question to try to address. Okay. So what does Polyakov say? Why wouldn't it be stable? And there's been a lot of work over the years looking at infrared problems in the sitter space from a variety of points of view. We've done some work, other people, Mottola and company. There have been a lot of sort of niggling hints or disturbing statements that indicate that the infrared problems of the sitter space might just be such that you can't really do the field theory the way you want to do it in the sitter space. what Polyakov's saying is that, in fact, one thing that you can try to address is, suppose you adiabatically turn on an interaction in the far past and just let the system evolve. His claim is that, for example, suppose you do phi 4 in the sitter space. His claim would be that because I don't have energy conservation anymore, I would actually be able to have vacuum to four particles, have that process go on. And then, of course, on top of that, each particle I make itself can go 1 to 3. So, in fact, I would have a runaway cascade of particle production. And though no one can really calculate this, the worry would be that you actually make so many particles in this process that, first of all, you overwhelm any perturbative. You might say, well, I'm just doing perturbation theory, so surely perturbatively it should be under control. But you might actually be, this is all tree level. These are all tree processes that would be happening. You might be able to build up particles so quickly that, in fact, their back reaction would overwhelm the effect of cosmological constant in the de Sitter space. And, in fact, you'd be driven out of that into some leftover FRW at the end. That's certainly what Polyakov would like to have happen. Yeah. It doesn't really apply. I mean, a long time ago, right? So Merville, that's this sort of statement here. There are a lot of calculations that purport to compute this particle production, okay? And if you look at them carefully, what they all do is make the following statement. Let me look at this matrix element. This is the matrix element that if you were doing perturbation theory, this is what you would start from. I would have, say, the vacuum state to whatever many particle state you're trying to access, and you'd look at the matrix element of the interaction Hamiltonian between these two states. And the claim usually is that that's what I put in my, that's how I generate my S matrix element. This is the ingredient that goes in the full-on calculation to generate my S matrix element. And once I can generate that, I can calculate a rate. This is not so, and so Merville does that, and there are papers by Atsushi Higuchi, who was here during that workshop, where he just does this. He takes 5/4, he does the example that we're going to do. He looks at massless, conformally coupled 5/4 in the Sitter space and claims to find a decay rate for that. It's a bunch of Davies vacuum. That should give you pause right there, because you know, and I'll go through it in more detail, you know that massless conformally coupled 5/4 is conformal to flat space, to the flat space 5/4. And we know that the flat space 5/4 doesn't decay, doesn't exhibit any instability. Right, but I'm doing proper rate patch physics. Right, so I could, if I wanted to do global de Sitter. I'm really looking at, because that's what he does as well. He does conformal patch physics, looks at conformal patch modes. Okay, so that's a worry. So the question, so at some level, what it boils down, what we're really trying to do is understand if this matrix element is not zero, what does it really mean? Does it really automatically mean that there's a decay, or does it mean that there's something more subtle going on? And this particular example that Higuchi brought up kind of tells you that there's probably something a bit more subtle going on.
Usually, to calculate your matrix element, you use the vacuum of the free theory. And naively, that matrix element is different from zero. 5^4 contains 4A dagger that acts on the vacuum and gives you 4 particles.
Sure.
Now, the solution in flat space would be, I should use the true vacuum of the theory if I were able to do
right,
that.
So
and this vacuum would be an eigenstate of the entire.
Right. So in fact, that's the whole issue of this adiabatic turn on and the dressing of going from the bare vacuum to the dress vacuum. And we'll address that. Okay.
So I forget how it works for the, if you've gone in the global thing and haven't been on the Poincaré patch, is there, then there's a time like, Is it future pointed everywhere, or is it because I know there's the t coordinate kind of goes backwards on the wrong side of the
right? You're thinking like the generator of boosts in the global
patch. I just used
But that's, I mean, typically that's not what's used. I mean, if you look at Polyakov, he's just using the Hamiltonian. He's doing interaction picture physics in the global patch.
And there must be some story then about do you have a Cauchy surface there?
He's not really thinking of it as an initial value problem. He's just doing this adiabatic turn on, really kind of more of a boundary value problem.
But he must have started with some state, right? That normally.
Yeah, in the far past, it starts with the Bunch state space field.
But is that on a surface which is a Cauchy surface of the whole place, or just for the patch?
I think just for the patch. I think that the way that works is just for the patch.
But this is a problem in global, because I think usually you turn on your interaction sometime T naught, and then that break. But when you do that, you break this.
That's how we do it. But in general, if you're doing field theory, right, the statement is that you turn on your interaction in the adiabatically in the far past. And then you just sort of, you build up from the free vacuum to the dress vacuum, and then go from there.
But past this time in this Poincaré patch.
Right. Okay. So basically what we want to try to address is
this how it shakes out. I mean, what is the significance of this matrix element when you're trying to address this question? So, again, In the sort of Zappa spirit of things, if you want to know what happens to a quantum state, do the quantum mechanics, right? And so here we're doing the standard what happens when you have when you go to interaction picture, your Hamiltonian, time evolution of the state goes with the interaction Hamiltonian, time evolution of the operators goes with the free Hamiltonian, and I can decompose my interaction state in terms of some complete set of states, whatever I choose them to be. Typically, I'll choose them to be the eigenstates of the free theory because, you know, it's way easier that way. And then I get a collection of equations for these time-dependent coefficients, right? That's sort of standard quantum mechanics. And this is, you know, at some level, this is a solution of the problem. But, of course, if I could solve this, I'd solve everything, right? And there would be no questions left to ask because I could actually just sit down and solve this. The problem is that this is an infinite-dimensional set of differential equations. It's hard to do anything with that.
It's just irrelevant to this.
Well, I mean, it's. I guess I would say I'm assuming existence or lack of existence to the same extent that you do it in flat space, right? I mean, you still calculate these same things in flat space. From the formal point of view, I don't really have anything useful to say on that point.
This seems like you're addressing a more formal question where these sort of worries might actually matter.
They would matter to the same extent that they would matter in flat space.
But isn't that because there's an infinite number of states and that's why they're orthogonal, that there's the overlap is small and then you take it over all possible modes at zero? And so that sounds like that's important there that you really go to infinity in the ultraviolet and zero in the infrared. If I had a finite number of states, then it wouldn't be orthogonal, right? So if we cut everything off, then it's probably not orthogonal.
Right. I mean, so, you know, we'll box normal. I mean, we'll quantize in a box and sort of keep track of things that way. I don't know. I mean, you might worry about those things, but I don't think they play in any more here than they would in the flat space case.
Okay.
As we go along, maybe shed some light on that as we go along and see how it all goes. So the way you make progress in dealing with this situation is, suppose you had
like one state that only coupled to either a finite number of other states or, I mean, the way I'm really thinking about it, the one state will be the vacuum, and say in 5/4, the quote-unquote finite number of states would be the four particle states, and I put quotes on it, but because, of course, I have all possible momenta for those four particle states, but they're finite in the sense that they're only the four particle states, as opposed to the six particle states, you know, higher end particle states. So I'm looking at this situation. So this is a truncation, and you can argue whether or not the truncation is valid. But it certainly will be valid if I'm at some fixed order in the interaction. So you say to first order, if I'm doing lambda 5/4, I can just look at four particle states here in the vacuum. So that I would only connect the vacuum to four particle states. I could truncate the system of equations to that sector, and then try to solve those, all right? And so you can do that. And so in that case, life gets a lot easier. You can actually solve for the coefficient of the multiparticle state, the C kappa. So kappas are the other states other than the vacuum that I'm considering. You can solve for those directly in terms of the coefficient you're looking for. Because what I want to do is I want to say I'm going to set the initial value problem that I start off in the vacuum, say with this guy 1, all the others 0. And then I want to look at the time evolution of this guy.
You have in principle an infinite number of things.
Right.
And then how do you stop?
I stop it by doing, I'm doing perturbation theory in HI. So to a given order in HI, only a certain set of particles can get connected to the vacuum.
From one, yeah, but the thing is that your equations then relate them to the next ones, and they're all related to more, and then more and more.
Right, so, I'm stopping it at, but the, all those other relations are higher order in the interactions.
Yeah.
So they're higher order in the small kappa.
Does that mean that that it's sufficient to be working in perturbation theory for this to work, or are you making another approximation?
You'll see. Just give me a slide.
That wasn't yes or no.
I mean, no, you'll see. It will all take care of itself. Truly. So when you put it all together, what you generate is the differential. You generate an integral differential equation for the coefficient you're looking for what happens to the state A as a function of time. Okay? And there's a kernel, and the kernel involves sort of going from A to these other states, and then going from those other states back to A.
You did in that running that line. So you wrote your equations out to first order in H. So
right.
Or second order, maybe.
I mean,
some order, but the thing is that then what you did is you said...
I look at this. These are my equations, right?
Right.
And so I said, suppose I only have a certain collection of states n, and only one state n.
Right.
Okay. That have a non-zero transition amplitude.
Right. So if I do c dot for the vacuum, then I keep all the guys
that are vacuum. Right.
But if I take now the guys that were appearing on the right hand side of the equation, I look at their dot. What do you do with them?
Well, I solve it. Right? I mean, this is a dot of the other guys solved. Because they only go back to the one guy. That's the assumption.
So you go back to the previous slide, if you show us that again. On the right hand side, the M, sum over M is just including the vacuum only.
Right, for those other guys, right.
Okay.
Right.
So that's more than perturbation theory. Because in the same order, that those states could have been related at the same order. To other states.
Well, but they won't be right. And for the interaction that we'll look at, say for 5/4, there's vacuum to first order in HI, there's 4 particles. And then those 4 particles to that order in HI will only go back to the vacuum.
But the same strength, they go back to the vacuum, they go to a bunch of other states.
Yeah,
and you're truncating those, right?
The same order in the perturbation theory, right? I think that's right, that they can
really see. The 4 particles, I mean, they'll go to...
At the same strength that they go back to the vacuum, they could have also gone somewhere else. And so what you're doing is you're going to cut those off.
That's true. I'm only looking at these transitions. Yeah. Right. I mean, that's my truncation that I'm looking at. So if you do that, you have this, and you need to try to solve this integral differential equation. Now, what you can try to argue is that this kernel depends on the interactions, and we're doing perturbation theory in those interactions. So you can make an argument that perhaps the kernel is slow because it's perturbative. That within this range, perhaps, or within this range over here, perhaps not so much as changing in here. That I could, in principle, take this CA out and actually just evaluate it at the time t, and actually turn that into a regular differential equation. I'm just doing standard quantum mechanics, but I'll break it because I'm setting an initial time.
I mean, that doesn't break the set of invariants. I mean, that's just a perturbation theory statement and a truncation of what states I'm allowed to consider. But I could just, that's not a question about whether the states are the set of invariants or not.
It seems to me that it's a statement about the interaction, not in the set of invariants.
I mean, the interaction, you know, it's time dependent. It's so in this case, I'll have scale. There are scale factor pieces, but the interaction is whatever it is. I mean, that's defined. That's given to you from the Hamiltonian, from the Lagrangian, right? I mean, I get that from I just get that from the Lagrangian. So I don't know. I don't really quite know how to make that.
But then it also would tell you whether you were allowed to cut off that the states that you can consider.
How does the sitter invariance feed into that?
Well, how can you implement this cutoff on your states without breaking the sitter invariance?
I'll turn it around. What does the cutoff of the states have to do with the sitter invariance? I mean, the sitter invariance is just a statement as to whether I have a certain set of generators of the set of symmetries that are respected. That's one statement. But whether or not what collection of the full Hilbert space of states I decide to keep, that's a different question altogether.
I would have thought it was connected by a Ward identity.
I don't think so.
It must be like a Poincaré. The same thing happens with the Poincaré invariance of flat space, right? That the Lagrangian transforms and the vacuum was invariant, so that means there's a bunch of states that will transform under some representation that you can get with one of your H's.
Right.
And then you'll be summing over those representations, and as long as he doesn't do that sum in a funny way,
right,
it could have been invariant.
Right, so...
Yes, yeah, but it's not clear to me. You can't cut it off.
But I mean, if I look at all possible... So, I mean, if I look at all possible four particle states...
But in the Poincaré case, you're happy that it works, right?
Yeah, so, but...
Those transformations don't generate, one particle state to a two particle state.
Right.
So that's the point.
Which transformation is
that? The Poincaré zone.
Yeah.
Right?
So he's...
Okay.
So that's... Right, so that's the issue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay? So what I'd like... So life would become much easier in solving this if I could just take this coefficient out. And what that really is a statement about a Markovian approximation, that somehow the kernel doesn't contain so much memory that it remembers so much that I have to keep this going all the time. Now, of course, I would like to actually do the approximation, do something more careful. So here's what you would do if you were very naive. This is what you would get
for your coefficient Cn. Okay? Just pretend that this guy just... There's not much change in here. I can pull this guy out and solve the differential equation. That is a little bit naive, but in fact, I can actually generate a full approximation scheme known as the Markovian approximation. I can systematize that to get a derivative, to get an expansion, which essentially winds up being a derivative expansion for the coefficients of the vacuum in this case. Okay, so basically what I do is I say, take this kernel, define something. I want to do a whole load of integration by parts, is what it is. Okay? So I define these W. So W0, the derivative of W0 gives me the kernel. And then I do an integration by parts. And I pick up this term. And this term, this is W0 evaluated at both times, at the same time here, and only CA. And so that's nice in terms of being able to pull the CA out. That's essentially this kind of approximation right here. And then this term over here, this is already second order. This W0, because it's related to the kernel has two insertions of the interaction. So it's already second order in the interaction. C dot, from the equation of motion for C dot, is also related to the kernel. So it, too, is already second order. So this term is fourth order in the small coupling. Okay? So, in fact, I could throw this, I mean, I could imagine just throwing this term away, and that would give me this coefficient. But in fact, I could actually do a little bit better. And in fact, I need to do, for what we'll talk about later, I need to do a little bit better. So let me do this, play the same game again. Write this guy as a derivative of a W1. Do the integration by parts. And that generates a term. Here's the term that I get from this piece. And then I get a term proportional to C dot at the time t. And then stuff that is higher order yet in the interactions. Okay, so this being able to extract CA and its derivatives and so on at the given time, that's what I'm calling the Markovian approximation. And it's basically, I'm allowed to do it from the point of view of perturbation theory because I'm really, all the other terms that get higher and higher order in the perturbative expansion. Okay?
you're assuming that sigma as a function of t minus t prime is strongly peaked around zero, so that you're getting mostly contributions near t prime.
Right. And that
claim I could, well, it's not so much that. I mean, if it were that way, that would be very nice. Okay? But what I'm really doing is relying on the fact that the other contributions that might remember more a higher order in the coupling. Yeah, I guess you could think of it that way, right. Yeah, right. And when you do that, so keeping that other term, the C dot term that I generated from this integration by parts, I kept it because there was already a C dot term in the original equation. So I bunch everything up, and I can solve, and I get this form, where this epsilon is this quantity. It's the W naught that I had before, but now there's a 1 minus this W1. And if you really believe that perturbation theory is all you have to worry about, then it would be the W naught that I had, which was the full Markovian solution, plus higher order corrections. The reason I'm going to keep it like this towards the end is that there's a statement about what's secular in time that you have to worry about. So usually you think of this picking up an e to the minus I energy times t. So that's a statement of that the W0 piece looks secular. It goes linearly in time. It grows in time. And that's how you extract the energy out of for the system. You could worry, and in fact, we'll find that we have to worry, that this piece down here could also grow secularly in some situations. And in which case, you could imagine a cancellation of the secularity between these two things. And so it is safer to keep this form, and sometimes you'll be able to expand it out like that when you can check that you don't have secular growth. Okay, so, but to this order in the perturbative expansion, in fact, a little bit better than the perturbative expansion because I have this 1 over 1 minus W1, which is order lambda fourth. I'm actually, this is a solution to the coefficient CA.
No, I mean, to the extent that I'm using H0 as
the generator of time translation, I mean, H as a generator of time translation, that'll always be there. And when you go through the calculations in detail for a given system, you'll see that the energy is conserved in that case. Okay? And in fact, we'll do it in just a second. All right? So the bottom line is, in the Markovian approximation, I get this for the vacuum coefficient, and I get this, when I take this result and reinsert it back, I get this for how the other states, how the amplitude of the other states evolves in time. Now, notice that what you would have done if you were just doing first-order perturbation theory, what you would have done is just written something like this for that matrix element. And what that corresponds to, if you match these two, is that, in fact, what this corresponds to is a short-time approximation to this. This resums. This actually, it's like, in fact, it's exactly equivalent to the dynamical renormalization group in that it resums secular terms out to large time behavior. So, in fact, this is the, if you're worrying about what happens at late time, you really have to use this. These types of matrix elements, which is what are used by Myhrvold and Higuchi and other people, these guys really are not valid to explore late time physics. Well, that depends on the problem. So this will be late. In this case, it'll be late, certainly late compared to h to the minus one when we talk about the inflation, the Sitter case.
Lagrangian for lambda phi the fourth, say, and I calculated what sigma was.
Yeah.
Would it have this property that it's strongly peaked in the sense that the, because it's only for frame of time, so that must mean that there's.
Dude.
If I'm at different, if things are related by light cone but well separated in time, will it be small?
I do that. Okay. So anyway, so this
is the formalism. So what I'm going to do now is actually look at, I'll use this to calculate how the vacuum coefficients grow, how the other coefficients grow, and so forth. But a question that you might ask is, I mean, it is an interesting approximation and all. Does it actually give you the right answers? I mean, you might worry about that. Approximations are like that. And of course, to answer that question, you need a system where you might actually know what the right answer is. So let me look at a situation where the interaction Hamiltonian does not depend on time already. So I have time translation invariance, and I can actually solve all these equations directly. Okay. So, for example, in that case, here we are. If I look at the kernel sigma to start off with, it has time translation invariance over here, and I can rewrite it in terms of a spectral density, rho, and still having this time translation over here, and then sit down and actually, because I have the time translation, if you remember the equation for A, it's C dot A plus a convolution integral times CA, of sigma and CA. And that means I can use a Laplace transform to solve that, because I have an initial value problem. I can solve the Laplace transform equation for CA of T, do the Bromwich contour, et cetera, et cetera. And what I find is something like this, where my CA is this integral, where this quantity I of omega that I'm integrating is involves a spectral density. Okay. Now, lots of words. What does it boil down to? Remember that we're still doing perturbation theory in HI. So perturbatively, if there were no HI, if rho were zero, then this I would be zero, and the pole would be near the origin. Okay? And in fact, the late time behavior of the system is dominated by the poles that are closest to the real line. Okay? And so what I'm going to do then is take this I of omega, expand it out near the origin, near omega equals zero, and then put it back in here and do the contour interval. And when you do that, first of all, the expansion of I omega gives you these terms, and these are exactly what you would recognize from doing second-order perturbation theory as the shift in the energy, the wave function, or something related to the wave function renormalization, and the decay width. Okay? And when you put all these things together, you find that here's how... In this case, doing it exactly by doing a Laplace transform and all this is what the coefficient for the state A looks like. There's a wave function renormalization. There's a shift in the energy that gets renormalized by this wave function renormalization and a decay width. Okay. Now, the question is, will this actually be seen? Will this actually be captured by the Markovian approximation? And bottom line, yeah. If you sit down and you calculate what shows up in the phase, you get something like this for the phase for the coefficient CA. And then you have to ask questions about the late time behavior of this quantity. And there are a whole bunch of distributional identities that you can use. But the bottom line is you get the exact same result as when you can do the problem exactly. Okay. So from that perspective, the Markovian approximation is not a bad one to use if you're trying to match to stuff that you already know. Okay? So, do we believe? Have I said enough words to make that plausible?
I'm looking at Cliff. He's the danger mouse of this one, right? Okay, so given that, let me now just quote, you can actually sit down and just calculate.
Let me just quote some results applying this to field theory in flat space, because these are the cases that I want to compare to when I do the De Sitter case. So let me do 5/4 in flat space, and I'm going to normal order it. And the reason I do that is I want to have it just connect vacuum to 4. Whereas if I had tadpoles, if I did in normal order, I could also, on top of that, connect vacuum to 2. And so the system of equations gets much larger. It's much, much more painful to do. I'm not into pain. I'm not doing it. So, I will do the normal ordering, and I will only keep track of vacuum to 4 amplitudes. And so the bottom line is when you look at what this quantity is doing, is it's actually calculating this three-loop diagram, which is the correction, which encodes in it, amongst other things, the correction to the vacuum energy, given that because I'm doing normal ordering, the figure 8 diagram that would be the leading contribution isn't there anymore. Okay? So you can calculate this kernel. So this is your question, Cliff. You can calculate the kernel, and there's this exponential behavior, and there is this the spectral density just has this form. So, yeah.
You could just have done normal perturbation theory.
Sure, absolutely.
This case, there's no reason to resend. Is there a flat space here?
Well, in flat space, what questions do you usually try to address? I mean, you never ask the question about what happens at late times in flat space, because you're usually calculating just corrections to two-point function, corrections to four-point function, you know, whatever, those kinds of corrections. Those aren't time-dependent ones. You never ask that question. Okay, and the standard flat space is here. So here I am. I want to ask those questions. I want to understand time dependence. So I need to keep track of that. So I do it this way. There's other ways you could do it in that case.
You could have time dependence that decays and take time. You have to have time.
So
this one is not.
This one had better not. Right. We certainly have to believe that if you do the vacuum in 5/4 in flat space, that vacuum is stable. If it's not, something has gone horribly wrong.
No, I guess what I'm asking is whether when you do the, so you're saying here, you're setting up the time-dependent calculation in fast space. I guess the time dependence is all in your choice of initial state.
I'm taking the vacuum initially.
So where is the time dependence coming in first?
Well, I mean, the time dependence comes in, basically what you get two, from this, when you go through the technology that we just did, you get two pieces. You get a wave function renormalization, which gives you the standard answer for wave function renormalization.
Why is your vertex, sorry? Why is your vertex time dependent? Why is H?
That's just an issue of going interaction picture, right? When interaction picture, I have e to the I h not t, e to the minus I h not t on all my operators.
Oh, obviously.
Yeah?
So I guess you're saying it's always there.
Yes, that's always there. And in fact, it better always be there, because what do you know has to happen? The vacuum should be stable, but it should also pick up a phase because there's an energy shift. So in fact, this actually exactly tracks that. I pick up the energy shift. Here's the shift in the ground state energy that comes from this diagram. So everything is exactly as nature intended, right? I do pick up, there is time dependence, but it's exactly benign kind. It's just a phase, okay? And I pick up a wave function renormalization, and it is what it is, okay? And on top of that, I calculate the decay rate, and it's zero the way it should be, because the vacuum energy is zero. This delta function can never be zero. We're done. Can never not be zero. Sorry. The argument, you know what I mean.
One,
that's right. And so you would have said, oh my God, something's happening. I'm getting this decrease. Clearly something's gone amiss.
So if you were to plot sigma as a function of t minus t prime, what's it look like?
Offhand, I don't know.
But it sounds like the statement is that you're saying that it's peaking with some width.
With some width, right.
And then what sets the scale for the width?
Well, let's see. I mean, it would have to be, I mean, what are the quantities that show up here? These guys.
But somehow the statement in frequency space would be that the rest of that stuff is somehow roughly independent of omega prime.
Because that would give you the delta function, right.
Yeah. And
right.
And eyeballing that, does it look like it's independent?
Well, I mean, the omega prime dependence showing up here. I can try to do it. I haven't done that. It's worth asking that question. Okay, so this is a case for 5/4. Mm-hmm. I thought I had two key slides. I've forgotten. So the other case I want to tackle is going to be more, it's going to turn out to be the more relevant case for the situation we want to calculate. Let me pretend I have two fields for now. I'll say one massive and one massless, for example, or lesser mass, where there can be a tree-level decay, right, of one particle to two particles. So here, if I ask questions about what happens to the vacuum, again, I have this vertex, and then this combination gives rise to this correction to the energy. All right? You go through it all over again, and you get expressions. You get a sigma, you get a spectral density, and you get certain expressions for the shift in the energy, the wave function normalization. But once again, the vacuum is stable, as it should be. Okay? I just picked up a phase. All right? And in fact, in this case, to compare to later work, if I take all the fields massless, I can actually do these integrals. And I get quadratically divergent shift in the energy and a linearly divergent thing in the exponential here for the wave function normalization. Okay? And epsilon is a regulator that I use in my doing my K integrals. So epsilon has dimensions of length or time.
And it also shows you that the width of that thing is set by m squared b in that case.
Right, right, right. Okay.
So if I did the very same in a normal perturbation theory, time dependent but normal perturbation theory, I would find intermediate vacuum going somewhere else.
Well, it's, right, that's these guys.
These guys, right?
So right, but I would.
You do better.
As right, I mean, so you would, again, once again, it's basically like expanding this exponential and saying, oh, it looks like there could be some vacuum decay because I've got a piece showing up there. But in fact, when you resum it, it just resums to exactly what you wanted it to, just the phase
at
that there was a at late time. Right. These are asymptotically late time statements. Okay? So these are the things we can do in flat space that I want to compare to in the De Sitter case. Alright? And in the De Sitter case, instead of just taking two separate fields here, I'm going to take one field, so it'll be a cubic interaction, and I'm just going to ask whether vacuum can go to 3. All right, so what are we doing? You know, people that I've been hanging around with know this story. I was once told, little steps for little people. I've lived by that motto ever since. And being a little person, I'm going to do the easiest calculation. I'm going to take a massless, conformally coupled, that is, C equals 1/6 field, and put various interactions. I'm going to put a phi-fourth interaction, and then I'll put a phi-cubed interaction, and see what the difference is in those cases. So, and why do I do that? I do that because these Hankel functions in that case are much, much simpler. They're just plane waves in conformal time. And so, that way it's exactly like the flat space case. Now, of course, the real fun case to do would be where you do the massless, minimally coupled case and put the interactions in. And that, of course, as we'll get to in the discussion part, that's the next step to do. But if I can't do this one, let's put it that way. If I don't know how to do that one, things will go poorly later on. So I'll do the usual things. I'll do a conformal rescaling of the field. I go to conformal time. Everything looks like flat space. In this case, for x equals 1/6 and massless, this term vanishes. The interaction Hamiltonian takes this form. I have a chi to the p where p will be either 3 or 4. When you scale everything out, it looks like this. So now my interaction Hamiltonian has explicit time dependence coming in from the scale factor. Okay? In terms of the field that looks like the flat space field. Alright? So I'm going to do exactly, and everything else now goes exactly the same way. Instead of time, I do conformal time. But these are my equations for the various coefficients exactly the same way. This is the Markovian approximation for the solution. Now, I can just go back to the previous two examples and see what happens in this case. Okay, so no subtleties. This part of it has no subtleties at all. I'm just doing quantum mechanics for this system. So, let's look at the first example. Phi-fourth again, and you work through it. Because this case isn't that interesting, you work through it and you find that in terms of the rescale field and conformal time, everything happens exactly as in flat space. You don't get any vacuum decay. You pick up a phase corresponding to the shift in the energy, which is the same shift in the energy as you would have gotten in flat space. And you get a wave function renormalization that just kind of sits there. Nothing happens. Nothing should have happened. If you go back, here, when p equals 4, there is no time dependence in here. Everything is flat space. So I should have seen nothing. Okay? Whereas, if I do what other people have done, Higuchi and Mervold and company, and say, oh, well, I have that matrix element, clearly that's an interaction. I will sit down, use it to calculate an S matrix element, and then use that to calculate a rate. You can calculate a rate. It just doesn't, it means nothing. It's not what you get from the late time behavior or anything like that. When you actually sit down and ask this question, what is happening to the state? that calculation that you would do. What it's really telling you about is what happens with the adiabatic theorem. When you start from minus infinity, turn on the interactions adiabatically from the free field one to this. This is what shows up to this order in the interactions. This is what you're getting. That's the significance of this matrix solvent from this perspective. You are dressing the state. The true vacuum state is not just a bare vacuum. It's the vacuum plus all these multi-particle states that you get from doing this time evolution. And so what you're seeing, what he should have been seeing but didn't, but claimed to call it a decay rate, what he really is seeing is the dressing of this state. And we can show, yeah.
I should just defend it. I think in that paper, Iguchi though is more. I think he's saying because I thought Iguchi was making the point in fact that yes, you find a decay rate, but you should not trust it.
Well, he does say that, but
you should not trust it because it's an inadequate. And then he has another paper which a simpler model where he shows it.
Well, he does an N squared. He does the N squared one, which I think is a little bit bogus. I mean, it's not an interaction, right? I mean, honestly. Perhaps it's a little bit of a struggle. He does say that. There are issues that he doesn't say why you shouldn't trust it. And, you know, to be honest, if I can't trust a calculation at that level, or I get a rate, and then he says that he doesn't know that it's really a rate for anything, I don't know why I do it. Right? I mean.
But he must have been motivated by the optical theorem or something that he's
calculating. I mean, well, that's exactly it. So, a lot of these people are basically motivated by optical theorem type statements. And it's not clear to me, I mean, optical theorem. I'm not sure how that really works. If I'm talking about unitarity, which is really what's at the backdrop of the optical theorem, unitarity in this case, the only way you can really, what you understand by unitarity is that the sum of the mod squares of these coefficients, C, is 1. That's unitary. Right? Bottom line, when you're doing this time-dependent type problem, that's unitary. Okay? And if you can calculate those coefficients and do it, there, you've checked unitary. If you can't, I'm not sure, because the optical theorem relies on there being an S matrix type statement to put down. And it's not obvious at all that that's actually relevant in this case. In fact, I mean, if you go with Witten, right, you're not even sure there's an S matrix to be defined in this situation, let alone that this calculation is capturing what the S matrix should be doing. You don't know that you have asymptotic state. You don't know any of that. So, I mean, but I do believe you're right, that they were motivated by optical theorem type statements. I just don't think they apply. But this applies.
Why can't I have asymptotic states that are based on, instead of, I'm not using them, they can't be flat or anything, but I base them on the states for, you know, the sitter states, the ones that were eigenstates of the time like Kelly vector in the sitter states.
That's not the bunch, those wouldn't be the bunch data states.
Those are not the bunch data
states. Yeah. I mean, you could do something with it, but they won't be the bunch data states.
So you don't have cluster decomposition.
What's that?
Yeah, you won't have cluster, right.
So how do you define, how do you separate?
Why do I need that? In the sense that if I have, you're saying I can't move them apart from each other, so that, but if,
yeah.
If I get to make choose the size of the packet or something, can I?
Say yeah, but you have to make it like order H or something, right, or H to minus 1. But anyway, our statement is that what he really was saying was exactly this dressing up process. Okay, and when you do it right, there is no vacuum decay. I mean, and because there can't be. I mean, there really can't be.
But I'm going to persist. So no. I know that there's formally in quantum mechanics, if I can, I'm just dividing the Hamiltonian into something I can solve, something I can't solve.
Right.
So if I can solve the problem of free scalar field, say, on sitter space, that'll be my unperturbed thing, and that should define my.
Then
I'm adiabatically turning on some interaction and turning it off.
So then
I could, in terms of that adiabatic turn on and turn off, I have asymptotic to sitter states. And so I could ask for an S matrix between.
Well, I don't know what asymptotic, I mean, you know, you have, it's time dependent throughout, right? So if, I mean, I would believe statements if you could actually go to asymptotic flat states in Kosky, where there's no time dependence going on.
But the time dependence in the de Sitter program, when I've turned this interaction off, are ones that I've solved exactly, even though it's time dependent, because that's the case you can solve exactly, right?
Yeah.
So then even though it's time dependent, I know what the exact solution is there. So I'm just looking at the deviation from, it's like you know, distorted Born.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of wave Born approximation where I exactly do the strong interactions, but I perturb the weak interactions. So I'm just turning on this lambda phi, the fourth interaction, and that's the thing which is defining the interaction picture. But the de Sitter part of it is in the unperturbed Hamiltonian.
But But I mean, well, I mean, you can't separate because the disturbance is also in the perturbed one as well, right? Because of the scale factors. Well, not no, sorry, not in this case, not in 5-4.
That's fine. I do not yet. The thing is that then it sounds like the Higuchi would have been right in the sense that it's in the optical theorem kind of argument you'd want to make is for the anode transition because that's because you're saying that the fact you got an imaginary part was that the state was no longer the probability of being in that original state is not 1, so the amplitude had to go down. And so what's wrong with that argument? That's, to the extent that there was an argument there.
I mean, if he had done all, okay, so if you go through that procedure, which I don't believe is what he did, certainly not the way I'm phrasing it for the stuff that we did. Maybe if you do that calculation, you would actually see this mismatch between in out states. But it's kind of weird, right? Because if 5/4 massless conformally coupled, you shouldn't see that. Because it's like, it is flat space.
Yeah, I'm not sure that makes sense.
Right, so from that perspective, that to us, that was a smoking gun. Had he done it for some other theory where you saw scale factor, then blah, 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 then you could have said, yeah, that's how it shakes out. But for that case exactly, you shouldn't have seen that.
That makes it sound like he just made an error in calculating the... Because you said the calculation he does is not the loop. He does the term change.
It's just tree. It's a tree calculation, right? It's vacuum to 4.
And but why does the kinematics... So the kinematics, in that case, allows you to go
right.
Vacuum to 4,
right?
Right. And there's no...
Because of... Right. The all the momentum, you can make the momentum shake out, and there's no energy conservation. So, all right. Just to, because I'm sure we're all ready for lunch at some point. Let me do now the 5Q case. The 5Q case now has scale factor dependence because it's not a scale invariant interaction. So you go through the same calculation, and the easy part is that all the phase space integrals are like in the flat space case, except for time dependence over here because of the time dependence in the coupling. You've got these time dependences here translated into these pre-factor time dependencies there. Everything else, though, is exactly as it was in flat space, so you can do that integral and you get the sigma. From that, from the procedure, from the MR Cobian approximation, you figure out what the amplitude is doing. So now, there's a phase, and it has this behavior, and as epsilon goes to zero, or as eta goes to late time, there's some divergences, and there are renormalization issues that you have to deal with that I'm not talking about, but we addressed in our gem of a paper, so you should read it. But the more interesting part, so the imaginary part here, this phase part, it takes care of itself. It shifts to an energy, not a big deal. It's this piece now, the wave function renormalization. That's the interesting part. So what that's saying is that there is, as time goes on, as you go to late time, eta goes to zero, this quantity diverges, and therefore the exponential goes off to zero. So what is that saying? As the longer you wait, the less you overlap you have between the dress state and the bare state. Okay? And the amplitude for that state is going off to zero. So from that perspective, we would argue that you do get back in decay, and it's an infrared issue because the later you go, the worse the problem gets. Now,
what's the definition of V?
V is just co-moving volume of the box that you're quantizing in. Now, there's an interesting way of doing things here. I have this cutoff epsilon, which is a cutoff. It's a short distance cutoff. It's a space or time dimension thing. Let me suppose that the correct thing to say is that this epsilon is constant in physical coordinates. That's the cutoff is the cutoff of physical coordinates, and rewrite everything in terms of the physical coordinates. What you find is that the z0 is exactly the result, you get exactly the result from the flat space case, but now in terms of the physical volume. So really what's driving this mismatch in the amplitude is the growth in the physical volume. As volume grows, it gets harder and harder to make those states match up to one another, and this is the price you pay for it.
Is it right to think that vacuum decay invariant This is maybe a probe field of sitter, you're just saying that.
Absolutely.
It's not like a vacuum of the sitter decays.
No, no, I have background the sitter, I'm putting in a test quantum field, I'm looking at the I'm looking at the field, the Hilbert space of states for that field theory, defined in the background, and asking what happens to those states. So if I so what we're seeing here, if I populate those states initially, as time goes on, those states start to decay, the vacuum.
My cubed is unstable anyway, so.
Sure, but I'm doing perturbative stuff, so I'm not sampling large distances in field space, so that's not an issue. I mean, I could put a 5/4 term somewhere to stabilize it.
But you would still want to run away from zero.
Even local. Yeah, but you know, it's still I'm expanding around phi equals zero. Okay, so it gets, you know, to say it again, it gets harder and harder to overlap the dress state with the bare one as the universe expands. So the issue is, how do you find a decay rate when everything is time dependent, right? And the only way you can really do it is by looking for secular time dependence in this amplitude. That's what you're really looking for, and that's what this is doing.
So, yeah, but to go back to the last question, this could be interpreted maybe as phi, you know, in the sitter, I'm producing fluctuation for phis, and so then necessarily would move away from zero to phi.
I mean,
and then you would actually define a new vacuum at the new minimum.
Well, I mean, that's, to the extent that I'm doing perturbation theory, I don't think I should be able to see that. Right? I mean, that's a large, you would need a large excursion, or a large-ish excursion, to be able to start accessing that information. But even if I do that, I can actually still ask questions. What is happening to the vacuum state due to the 5-cubed interaction? And this is what's happening for that.
In principle, I guess you could follow C for the other states that you're following.
Absolutely.
They must be going up to...
Right. Okay, so this, at some level, this is our main result. The two big things for the paper are the formalism itself and this result. Now, there's an interesting aspect, and I'll just talk about it.
Before you take off that last slide, if you look at that expression for sigma naught, if it's the volume that's in the numerator there, that makes it seem like this narrow width approximation is going to be shady, right? Because it looks like the thing you're comparing eta minus eta prime to is the volume. Because you've got the m squared over a squared or something like that, some measure, that's the measure of the coupling in order of h.
Mm-hmm.
So then this approximation that sigma naught's acting like a delta function looks like it's suspicious. It reminds me of the paper that you and I wrote.
V's are moving here. V's constant?
Yeah, V's constant, yeah.
And sigma V's constant, V physical.
So a physical moving volume, right? The V
is moving.
Right. The V that's growing that we give rise to is this physical volume.
So how big should I think of V being?
Well, V is just whatever block size you decide to quantize in, right?
There'll be many, many H's or something.
It could be.
But then I have to wait in comoving time many times
later. Right, but I'm allowed to because this is late time, it's a resummation that captures late time, so I can control that. Okay?
But then it's that sort of physical that makes me think that I should care a lot about what I did on the boundary of the box, because you're waiting so long that waves are getting over the edge of the box, they're coming back, and it's true this is expanding, and so it's not quite mm-hmm. hot space, but my intuition is that you're waiting many volumes, times that are many light crossing times for the volume, that you're sensitive to how you set up the box. Yeah, and in the third place, that might not be right because everything's being.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you're going larger than h, right? You know, once you're looking at box sizes that are larger than h,
yeah.
I mean, you can't light cross.
Right.
So I don't think that's an issue.
And this is just an overall constant, right? I mean, it still has a peak, but you multiply it by a really large.
But he's made the assumption that the time frame of interest to him is long compared to this time frame.
Well, I didn't see him on the show again.
We have time.
Okay, so let me cut to the chase and we can do stuff afterwards. I had talked about before that the true thing you should have been calculating is this quantity over here, and I've been neglecting this red bit so far. And basically, I have been neglecting it. What you might worry is that this term actually might become secular. And actually, so what's going on? It's secularities in here that are driving, that's what's driving the late time behavior that's showing that you have this decay rate going off and killing the state. So it's these secular. So if this term on the bottom also became secular, you could imagine a cancellation in those. And in fact, to the extent that we can trust our perturbation theory and trust the Smart-Cohen approximation, you can actually sit down for the Phi Q theory and calculate this W1, and you actually find a secular term. And so what that's saying is that there are some delicate issues about the renormalization that I don't want to get into here that come into play at this point. But what it seems to imply, if we're believing what we do in the appropriate way, is that at late times, and I only cancel the late time behavior, if the imaginary part of this goes to a constant at late times, then what's that saying is that there's actually a state that doesn't move at late times. So it's like you're flowing towards some fixed point state that will just sit there. And you could imagine that would then be the appropriate state to be doing your field theory around. So this is just a conjecture. But if that were true, then you would have perhaps a small but non-zero overlap with the bare state. And this adiabatic catastrophe that Polyakov talks about wouldn't take place once you hit that state. So again, it's conjectural, and we have to do more work on it. But it's kind of an interesting... It is interesting that the secularity here comes into play. So finally, we have this formalism that this late-time resummation and can track the evolution of the quantum states, which if you want to understand what happens to the quantum states of your field theory, that's what you ought to do. Shut up and play your guitar. In conformally coupled, we see examples of vacuum decay in the Phi Q case. And when you're not supposed to see vacuum decay, we don't see vacuum decay. So we can trust the formalism to that point. It's a time-dependent wave function renormalization. That's really what's driving this decay. It's the fact that in flat space, you get something that looks like what I wrote down in the Sitter case, but they're all just constants. So it's just, there's a wave function renormalization. It is what it is. Move on. Okay? But here we have these time-dependent pieces that you can't get, that are trickier to get rid of. We did an analysis of what happens when you have one particle state decaying sort of within this approximation in flat space versus the Sitter. And the Sitter case has some really interesting things about how you populate super horizon modes and how you enhance the decays for super horizon initial states. So you should take a look at that. Things to do is how to go beyond this leading Markovian approximation to understand what are we really neglecting when we do this. And then what we'd really like to be able to see is to go to 5/4 and minimally coupled and understand whether we can see the mass generation that's supposed to occur at late times, how to see it from this formalism. That would be sort of the next level project to look at. So, thank you. I think they're calling us for lunch.
From the minaret, apparently. Yeah.
Yes. I should be getting used to that, right?
So I kind of was just asking a question. So it sounds like in your Markovian approximation, the thing that was bothering me about the volume, it sounds like, so is the kernel you're talking about there is not a correlation kernel. If
I No.
It's just a, so maybe if you rephrased it as a mean field approximation, then that would be, because normally what happens is that in this Markovian approximation, what you're normally asking is that correlations are dying off.
Right.
Not that two-point functions are dying off.
Right. Yeah, correlations.
And in such case, those can't be larger than the Hubble scale, you would have thought.
Right.
So somehow, if you phrase it in terms of mean field, deviation from mean field, then it would be more explicit that the mark you know that the thing that's controlling the Markovian approximation
is right. Now that might be a good way to see it. Although how to implement mean fieldness in this approach, I'm not right. I'm not quite sure.
Well, that's a general way for quantum mechanics. If you just take the time evolution in your U, and you write it as being the and you've got an environment and a thing you're following.
Right.
And the average of that evolution of U is the mean field thing, and then that doing it in terms of U guarantees that there's no interference between the
between mean field. Right. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Okay.
But why is it not the physical volume appearing from the very beginning? Can you be working actually?
I can quantize. I mean, I should quantize in a co-moving box, right? Because my k's are co-moving k's when I write down the quantization, and the box sort of the box normalization conditions are if I have co-moving k's, the conjugate variable is co-moving length scale, co-moving box.
Okay, so if you had worked in a physical fixed physical volume and physical momentum, you would have gotten the same answer.
Presumably, although it would have been harder to, I mean, I would have to write the modes all in terms of physical momentum and take whatever time derivatives show up are going to show up in there. It would be harder to do. That's why I'm moving.
It seems strange that the reason why your state decay is just because of the commoving mode.
Well, I mean, the larger the volume that you're trying to, the larger your box volume and you're trying to make your state sort of overlap with the dress and the bare states overlap over a large portion of space. That's got to cost you, right? And that's exactly the cost we're seeing here. In fact, it's very interesting that it actually does scale with the physical volume in this particular way. You could have thought that somehow, you know, the factors of eta would have shaken out differently, but it scales just right.
But isn't that telling you that the right eigenstates to choose in the beginning were the physical k's, which maybe is more what Louis was saying?
Yeah, can you choose a basis such that the vacuum of that basis does not have a k? It's a wave function minimization time.
Well, so that's what we're trying to argue at the end. This last number term of the thing is that, you know, if at late times you start to see this cancellation of the secularity, then you're exactly approaching those states.
So your conjecture.
Our conjecture is that would be the right thing to do if you could truly access those states in a controlled way. And we're not sure. We just see the baby steps towards, you know, what that state might be, but we're not sure we can really, you know, we're not sure to what extent we can really control the approach to it.
I'm still concerned with the way you set the problem up, because if I try to do it in flat space, what I would do is I would argue that the vacuum is Poincaré invariant. What does that mean? It means that the stress tensor acting on the vacuum is zero.
Mm-hmm.
The stress tensor it has many particles. It has 0.4 vacuums in there. So that's telling me where the story is.
That's a true vacuum, right?
That's the true vacuum.
Right, so I'm starting with the vacuum of the free theory, time evolving that, and seeing what happens. And so part of the story is that you do see the dressing up of the vacuum in terms of the multi-particle states. You do see that.
Yeah, but I can ask the question more without addressing it perturbatively at all. I'm asking the question in the end. I would be asking the question, is this theory going to break Poincaré invariant spontaneously?
Yeah, presumably not. Right.
And now the same question I can go to in De Sitter space. I have a De Sitter invariant vacuum, and if I recall, this was the argument against Mirvold in the 80s that he was hammered on the seminar circuit on this one. That the De Sitter invariant vacuum is, it has the same properties. The stress tensor acting on it, there's no evidence that it should break. Where is the decision?
It's being broken. So the way we do it, it's being broken by setting the problem up as an initial value problem. So I'm saying at some fixed time, set the state to be this. Time evolved from that fixed time. So in a sense, from that perspective, it's heartbreaking. And then I can take the time back to minus infinity, but it's still. You still see the remnants of that hard breaking by setting up as initial value problem. And when you do the Poincaré case, you're thinking of going into the infinite past, setting boundary, doing think of it as a boundary value problem. And so you don't do that hard setup. We're doing, it's an initial value problem.
But presumably if there is an end state, if you're flowing somewhere, then if you just started there,
then
when you do this procedure, you would have seen that if you started there and you used the right eigenstate, then it would be considered invariant.
Right. So at some level, and one way to interpret this, if our conjecture is correct, one way to interpret it is that we're finding exactly the right states to start from. In which case, you would actually argue that Poiseuille might not be right, because in fact, there are states that hopefully would be considered invariant that you could start from, and you wouldn't have this adiabatic catastrophe.
But it's the ad state. You choose different states to start with.
Oh, absolutely. So
you could
ask
that don't adjust.
That's right. So if you like, but if the claim is the sitter, then you really, really, really have to sharpen what you mean by the statement that the sitter is unstable. The sitter is unstable when you pick this state and do these things to it. Okay. Right. So, and in any case, one take home lesson from all of this, I would say, is sharpen the question. If you look at Poiseuille, he's probably right about everything because he's Poiseuille. But it's a very amorphous set of words that he uses. It's tenuous. You try to pin him down. He's like, you know, he's like a Zen master. You can always just, you know, escape it being pinned. So I think ultimately, if you're going to try to address this question, you have to sharpen the question up.
Intermission.
Well, thanks again.